Welcome to VCR, Vintage Cinema Rewind. We're bringing old movies to new viewers. I'm Blake.
And Blake, how's your entailment coming along?
You know, fun fact, I had to Google what entailment meant.
I have not Googled it yet. What does it mean?
Oh man, call me out on this. It's like, it's kind of like a state law. I don't know why. This is not interesting content, but it's like state law and waiting for your estate to get paid out to you, basically. Or somebody else's estate to get paid out to you.
Okay. Interesting.
There you go. What a weird way to start To Kill a Mockingbird. But here we are.
I mean, you never know what you're going to get with Vintage Cinema Rewind, but here we are.
Here we are, talking about one of the classics of both literature and cinema, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book and this movie are both kind of high school staples. Like, yes. Have you encountered this story before?
Yeah, I did. This is my second viewing of the movie because in high school we did read the book and watch the movie.
Okay, interesting. I actually, fun fact, somehow I avoided both the movie and the book in all my 31 years. So this was my first encounter with the movie.
I'm somewhat surprised by that, to be honest, just because like how classic of a novel it is, and the fact that, like you said, it's pretty prevalent in high schools, right?
Oh, I was kind of doing some research on just even the legacy of this story in this book, and it's insane, like, how it has just kind of become a cornerstone of, like, American literature or, like, American pop culture.
Yeah, and what I'll say about that as well is that, like, for me, I have really fond memories of reading this one, actually, in high school. Like, to contrast that, like, I was never a big English buff in high school. I was more of a math whiz, like communications, editing, all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Music, like everything else except for English. Like I kind of always struggled to, you know, get into like Shakespeare or read the like novels. Like, for example, the primary example I have of this is The Catcher in the Rye. I read that in grade 9, and the disdain that I have for The Catcher in the Rye after like almost 20 years is just as strong as it was back
really
then.
You know what, fun fact, I'm derailing the episode again, as I always do. I actually read that for the first time when I was 24, and I just reread it recently, and both times I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I hated that novel. Hated it with a passion, like a burning passion. As phony as whatever the guy's name,
Holden Caulfield. Yeah.
As often as he uses that, puke. Okay. Gross.
Okay. Well, that, I guess, join us on our adjacent podcast where Blake and I talk about books. But
I remember both reading this, and then I actually do have memories of actually watching this in high school, because this was one of two black and white films that we watched in high school, this and 12 Angry Men. And yep. Both of those films, in my opinion, hold up actually really well.
Okay. Interesting. Another fun fact, I read 12 Angry Men in grade 12, and they didn't show us the black and white version. They showed us like the 1997 version Tony Soprano. Yeah.
Really? That had James Gandolfini in it?
Yeah, that guy. So I.
Interesting.
The viewers watching at home are just thinking, like, what high school did Michael go to? Or, like, did he even go to high school? Like,
you went to a bizarre high school, and that's all we have to say.
I sure did.
But anyway, let's get back into To Kill a Mockingbird. This is our primer episode of this. This is the second part of our, or third part technically, I guess, of our Oscar series covering the 1963 Oscars, the 1962 films. We did Lawrence of Arabia to start, the one that won Best Picture, and a whole slew of other awards. This one was the one that was comparatively nominated for a lot of similar awards. It did win several, stole several from Lawrence of Arabia. And also, you know, it's got that courtroom procedural in it, that kind of crime type of film that is somewhat related to our current Oscar season with Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, what a weird parallel between 1963 and this year. Also, what a bunch of weird parallels between Lawrence of Arabia and To Kill a Mockingbird itself. Like, I was watching this movie recently for the podcast, and I was just, like, frowning. Like, okay, like, there have been some overarching themes in our selections.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, you could probably even write an essay about, like, the duality of Hollywood in 1962 with To Kill a Mockingbird and Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Yeah, kind of. This was the year of the white savior. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for my opinions.
Yes, and that's something that's pretty prominent, and I think that is something that we're going to probably talk about in a lot greater detail in the deep dive episode next week, but for now, that is something that, you know, keep in the back of your mind is going to come up at some point.
Yes, indeed.
Do you want to get started with the plot, and then we will get into the characters of people you may know?
So this movie is really interesting in that it was filmed in the 60s, but the story itself takes place in, like, 1934 or something.
Yeah, it's, like, right after the Great Depression or in the midst of the Great Depression.
Yeah, so this movie was, like, a period piece even back then. The whole story is framed through the point of view of this little girl, Jean Louise Finch, also known as Scout, right? And her father is, you know, the iconic Atticus Finch, a, you know, small town southern lawyer who helps people who are down on their luck. And anyways, throughout the whole year and a half that this story takes place in, Atticus agrees to defend a black man named Tom Robinson who has been accused of assaulting a white woman. And the story just kind of unfolds from there. It's kind of, it's interesting because you said that this was kind of like a crime courtroom procedural kind of movie, and there's definitely elements of that in there, but what surprised me the most was not those elements, but how few of those elements there are, if that makes sense. Like,
well,
this really is a story about growing up.
Yes.
In this very unique time in history.
It's unique, and you say that then, but as we all know and as we've talked about on this film, history often has a tendency to rhyme with the present.
Sure does.
And something like this, the themes and the ideas of this film, I feel like are just always kind of ever-present. And you might say that, okay, maybe not to the same level that they were in the 1930s, but not necessarily far off in all cases either.
No, I didn't mean to imply that we've solved racism.
But
good news, guys, we figured it out. No, like, it's unique in the sense that, like, it's, you know, it takes place during the Great Depression. This is a very, in Alabama, it's, the people are extremely impoverished. Like, it's just a very kind of almost pastoral look at the past.
Well, and the other thing as well, and you kind of touched on this a little bit in the structure of the story, but the structure in the structure of the story and the structure of the film, it's very different than like a three-act type of structure. The film almost feels like two very distinct parts to it, and that's something that's very prevalent in the novel. And so there's kind of two coinciding stories that are taking place in this film, and then they kind of crash together in the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right as well that, you know, this is a film about childhood, and there's nostalgia in this film. Like, this film feels very nostalgic of a past that, through the lens of a child, is very, like, important and very
moving,
yeah.
I might say.
Yeah. That's something that I think is really important to also note in this discussion, is that the film is framed as and narrated as if this person is reflecting on their childhood and how they saw the world at this point in time.
Yeah, right.
I think that actually is something that comes across very well in the film, is that, you know, I watching this, like, I did feel nostalgic for my childhood. Like, I do, when I'm watching this, reflect back on, you know, what my thoughts were as a kid, like how I viewed the world and all of that, and whether or not that worldview has changed over the years too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of charming. Like, the first hour of this movie almost kind of belongs to the kids, right? Like, it's Scout, she's hanging out with her older brother Jem and her friend Dill, and, like, there's this whole thing where there's this recluse who lives next door named Boo Radley, who, like, and they make up all these stories about him, about how he's, like, a monster who, like, eats cats or something. And, like,
right.
You know, at one point they, like, dare each other to, like, go over there and knock on the door. And, like, yeah, I was getting kind of, like, nostalgic too, watching those scenes. It was kind of like, oh yeah, like I remember being that small and having that big an imagination, right? Like,
right.
I remember like being a kid and like, you know, Blake and I grew up together, and it was like, you know, in Summer Vacation especially, it's like we just
in a small town.
Yeah, in a small town, you just found your friends, and it was like, all right, what do we do now? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there was that, you know, the house in the on the corner that was spooky kind of thing. And, like, even though we didn't share, like, our childhood was 60 years after the events of this film, there's something deeply connected in the feeling of what it's like to be a kid, right?
Something very universal about it, yeah. And yeah. The movie captures that. I don't actually remember that much of my childhood. Can blame the alcohol for that. But, like, no, but, like, watching this movie, I was getting some flashbacks. Like, oh, yeah, this is what being a kid felt like.
It captures that, and it does a really good job in part one of the film in capturing the essence of your childhood. And then it kind of does a little bit of a reverse, and it shows this very adult topic of racism and discrimination and everything. And it kind of, like, contrast those two ideas. I think it does it really effectively in the sense that, like, you know, you kind of then think about yourself as a kid and, like, the fact that these kind of thoughts, like, really never crossed your mind, like these kind of prejudices and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can kind of appreciate the idea of, like, we take kids and we put them in a very adult, complicated situation, and we see it through their perspective, right?
Right.
I mean, that was probably more effective in the book, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I can appreciate the, like, narrative technique of that.
Right. Yeah, for sure. So let's talk characters and people you may know. Usually, like, I like to describe the actors and, you know, some background about them and kind of connect them to modern day audiences. This movie did come out over 60 years ago, so you're probably not going to know many of the actors in this film except for one key performance, which I will get to. And also, both the kids, both Scout and Jem, as actors, didn't really move along in their acting career. Both of them retired as child actors, essentially. And
which is kind of surprising because, like, they're... Spoiler alert, the child actors in this movie are all really good.
Yes, and that's something that, like, can be very hit or miss in films, right?
Yeah, right? Like, you often get abysmal child performances, like, you know...
That can really sink a movie.
That can really sink a Phantom Menace, I mean movie, but, like... I was actually, like, my jaw was hanging open. I'm like... Wow, like, I believe these are kids just running around unsupervised in the 1930s. Like, I don't know who trained these kids or who directed them, but they did a really good job.
Yeah, for sure. So we've talked about some of the characters already, but to just kind of recap here, we've got Scout Finch playing about 6 years old at the time of the story, where it opens. The story's really framed around her and her observations of the world.
Yeah.
She's kind of a tomboy, and being a tomboy in the 30s is definitely frowned upon.
Yeah, I would say so, definitely.
And that's something that I think is really effective about this film as well, is showing a girl who really doesn't understand the world yet in being so young. I think the weight of the world hasn't hit her yet. Like, at this point, like, it feels like Scout could be anyone or anything, but in the 30s, like, obviously her options would have been significantly limited as she got older.
Sure would have, yeah.
You know, like, so that kind of plays in the back of your mind a little bit. Her brother, Jem, who's about 4 years older than her. I think it's really interesting having these two kids and their age separation and seeing kind of both of their perspectives of the world contrast each other even then, and how, like, you know, Jem's teaching her things about the world. And I think that their relationship is so crucial to understanding the film.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I, it's touching too, because you and I are both older brothers with younger sisters, so, like, it really put me back into that mindset as well.
Yeah,
and it is interesting how, like, we're seeing the world through the perspective of a child. So Scout is 6 and her brother Jem is 10. like neither of them are fully aware of what's going on, but there's definitely moments when Jem seems a little bit savvier about what's going on. Like there's that great moment where Atticus basically has to leave to go guard the jail for some reason, and Jem is the one who's like, let's go. Like, I just want to make sure he's okay, right? Yeah, and then right. Scout just kind of follows along. So, yep. like, it's almost like we're getting two removes from what's going on sometimes.
Yeah, and that's the next character that we need to talk about is Atticus Finch, who's the town defense lawyer. He's the primary protagonist of the film, even though, like, the film is viewed through Scout's eyes.
Yeah.
He's the hero of the story, essentially. Played absolutely fantastically by Gregory Peck, a name that you might have heard before.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Like, he absolutely deserved Best Actor for this movie.
I very much agree. His performance is, like, one of the best quiet performances of a film I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. No question.
You may know Gregory Peck because we've talked about him on this podcast before, if you're paying close attention to the Cape Fear episode, because he had a minor role as the lawyer in Cape Fear in the 1991 version that we talked about, but he was also plays Sam Bowden in the original Cape Fear.
Yeah. I was looking up that connection today and I was like, that is actually really funny.
Yeah. And
that's interesting.
And you and I have a plan of going back to some of the films that we've talked about that are remakes or sequels and that sort of thing at some point in time. And I think Cape Fear is one that you and I are both maybe somewhat interested in checking out from the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Cape Fear. I would definitely check out the original Cape Fear.
Yeah. You've already mentioned Boo Radley as well. He's kind of an enigma. He's a very interesting character in the sense that
I have a lot to say about Boo Radley next week.
Cool. He's almost not in the film. Like, we really don't even get to see who he is until the final 10 minutes of the film, or even like closer to the final like 3 minutes of the film. He's just,
and then when
presence.
He does show up, you still barely kind of understand who he is.
Yeah, like it's a very quiet performance. It's a very haunted performance. It's played by a very young Robert Duvall, who's one of my favorite American actors of all time.
Oh, yeah.
This is actually his first credited role as well, even though he doesn't even have a speaking part in the film.
Huh.
He kind of reminds me, actually, of like an early Johnny Depp. Like he's kind of got the looks of like an early Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of had that pretty boy thing going on for a moment in time.
Yeah, I did not actually expect that. I didn't remember his performance, like, you know, 15 years almost on, that he was Boo Radley, just because of, again, how little like physical screen time he has. He's a very like omnipresent character throughout the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, I mean, understated is almost an understatement.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting performance that it's weird. We'll talk about it in the deep dive.
Yeah, it's weird, okay, guys? It's weird.
Yeah. And then the last character that I want to mention is, actually, there's probably two characters that I want to mention to wrap this up. So the second last character that I want to mention is Tom Robinson. He's the black man accused of raping and abusing the woman defendant in the film. I can't even remember her name now.
It's Mayella.
Mayella. Yes, Mayella Ewell. It's a pretty quiet performance, again, that comes in the last part of the film. He doesn't get like a ton of screen time, but I think his performance, what little of it is in this film, is very impactful, is very well done.
I should say that, like, to this movie's credit, like, a lot of the times when I go back and watch movies from like the 60s or the 50s or the 40s, a lot of the time the acting in particular doesn't always hold up.
Yes. And you and I talked about that even in Lawrence of Arabia, right? Like,
yeah, we're just like, it's a little too, things could be a little theatrical back then.
Yeah.
I'm going to get hate for saying this, but a couple years ago, I went back and rewatched The Searchers, mm-hmm. the famous John Ford, John Wayne movie, and just some of the acting, I was trying to take the movie seriously, and I was like, oh, I know this is a classic, but come on. Like,
yeah, some of the theatrical performances, right?
Right, but like, I will say, to this movie's credit, like, all the actors are spot on.
Yeah,
there may have been a couple moments where I'm like, eh, but like, for the most part, like, the actors were on point. All the actors, all the performances, all the direction was on point for this movie.
Yeah, definitely. The last character that I want to mention, actually, I didn't even say who Tom Robinson's played by, but Tom Robinson's played by Brock Peters, who we actually quickly talked about last year as well, because he has a role in Soylent Green, film we talked about, Jason and I talked about. He also voiced Darth Vader in some adaptations on the radio of Star Wars in the 80s and 90s.
Interesting. I'm going to have to check that out now.
He also took place in some Star Trek films with the original cast, as well as Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So he is somebody that I guess either film nerds or Star Trek Trekkies are going to know for sure.
He definitely got around. Like, he definitely made his rounds as an actor.
Yeah.
I see he also got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1991, it looks like. Huh, good for him.
Yeah.
1992, excuse me.
It's a really good performance, honestly, and that's something that I will definitely be bringing up when we get into the deep dive. And the last character I guess we should mention as well, because he's a very large presence in this film, is Bob Ewell, Robert E. Lee, Bob Ewell.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Bob Ewell is one of the main characters in the film that it's actually, Maela is actually his daughter, and he's very protective of his daughter and is the one who's putting a lot of pressure on Atticus to drop the case and walk away from the case, and he's also just a complete caricature of racism and everything wrong with ignorance.
Hey, viewers at home, close your eyes. Now, picture white trash. When I say the word white trash, what comes to mind? It's this guy. I will say, this guy is, I guess you could call him the villain of the movie, and like, there's one scene in particular during the big iconic courtroom scene. There's a moment where Atticus Finch kind of bumps into him. Mm-hmm. This guy whirls around and delivers like the most sinister villain laugh I've ever heard emerge from a grown man's throat. Like, it's just, it's a little cartoonish, but it's just like, whoa. Like,
it's like despicably evil. Like, it's a performance that you're not going to forget. Honestly.
No, definitely a lot. It's fantastic.
Fantastic in all of the worst ways.
Yeah, basically. Imagine the Joker if he was from rural Alabama in the 1930s, and you kind of got this guy.
Yeah. The only other person that I do want to mention is the screenplay adapter, Horton Foote. He also did an Oscar-nominated film called Tender Mercies that he won an Oscar for, screenplay for, which is another film starring Robert Duvall. So another Robert Duvall specialty for the Oscars that I hadn't heard of before this, but I think the film historians out there are going to know that film most likely.
Yeah, good. Frankly, more movies need Robert Duvall. Like,
I agree. It's unfortunate that the man is in his 90s, although he's still acting.
He is still acting. That's right. So yeah. We are going to get more Robert Duvall, hopefully.
Wow, you just jinxed us. How dare you?
Sorry.
Anyway, who is this movie for, and does it hold up to a modern watch? We've already talked about how important this film is to high school literature and whether or not you got to watch the movie in high school as well, I guess. I actually kind of wonder if, as time goes on, if the film will be something that is able to stay in the culture longer than the novel will, just because of like the writing potentially getting dated as time goes on.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, we can talk more about this on the deep dive, but like, should I go first?
Like, yeah, go for it.
Who is this movie for and does it hold up? I'm going to answer the second question first. I feel like I'm always the contrarian on this podcast. I feel like there are like very, very, very well-educated, well-versed like film snobs listening, and they're always rolling their eyes at me. But in the interest of being transparent and honest, I don't really think this movie holds up.
Wow, I am shocked. I have a very differing opinion of you then, because I thought this film held up like significantly better than Lawrence of Arabia did.
I will agree with that. And I don't want to say this movie's bad because it is well made, but just in terms of the pacing and maybe kind of the broader messages, I don't know that it tracks so well in 2024, you know? You guys also have to keep in mind that, like, unlike most people in the West, I didn't grow up with this story.
Right.
Like, I never read it in high school. I've never seen the movie until now. Like, I'm a bald 31-year-old man experiencing it for the first time. So, like, it's kind of like if you showed me Star Wars now, having not grown. I had a kind of a, I guess you could call it an argument with my girlfriend this morning where she said she actually prefers the prequels to the original trilogy Star Wars. Yeah, so anyways, I'm single now, but but I was saying to her, like, I'm like, all those movies were so important to my childhood, especially 4, 5, and 6. I don't know how much I would like them if I saw them now for the first time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that definitely brings into that conversation, right, about whether films act as nostalgia for past times in your lives or whether they actually hold up as good pieces of film.
Well,
right?
It's just like, you know, I have this joke that like the music you liked at 16 is the music you like for the rest of your life.
Right.
So it's like, you know, this movie isn't, and this story isn't part of who I am. I'm coming into it with fresh eyes as a stranger, you know?
Yep.
Like, I kind of knew who Atticus Finch was. I kind of knew what this movie was about. But, you know, I came in very surprised, as I often do. So, as someone experiencing this movie and this story for the first time in 2024, at 31, with no hair, I didn't think it held up all that well. There are some incredibly iconic sequences, but, like, if you're asking me who's this movie for, like, I don't know that I have an answer to that question because I would assume most people have probably already seen it. And I know that experiencing it for the first time at 31 now, I was a little confused at parts and I was a little taken aback at different parts. So I feel like I have completely lost out of the original question and I'm just like having a breakdown on camera, like on screen, not even on screen, on microphone. See, like I'm not even making sense.
That's hilarious. What's really funny about that is like my opinion is somewhat completely different. Like I think that this is, and not necessarily entirely different actually, even though I disagree with you. Like I think this is a movie that I think everyone should watch at least once in their lives. And what you're saying is that a lot of people probably have already seen this once in their lives. To kind of build off of that, I think that this movie is a really great, and the novel, are really great introductions in your teenage years when you're starting to form these ideas and opinions of the world.
Yeah, I think like some British institution, I forget, said this is like the movie or the book that you should see or read before you're 15. I'm 2 15-year-olds smooshed together. I'm 31.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I think that the crowd who this movie for has either already seen it and is past that prime period or is a generation that, you know, is hopefully at some point even just provided the opportunity to read this and potentially watch it in school.
Yeah, right. And also, like, and again, we'll get more into this in the deep dive, but, like, our opinions on racism have evolved considerably since then, you know?
Well, yeah.
In a lot of ways, this movie and its message feels a little quaint at times.
Well, and that's something that you have to remember with the times, right? Like, yes, some of the ideas of the film. Like, I think the ideas of the film are, for the most part, ever...
Well, I think this movie is well-intentioned. I'm not... You know, we're living in a very different time.
Yeah, but I don't think that, like... I think that if you're viewing this as a lens of, like, oh, in 2024, like, we wouldn't, you know, treat black people like this in the courts. And it's like,
No. I'm saying kind of the opposite perspective, right? I'm saying, like, I think we have, hopefully anyways, we have a greater understanding of how insidious and how systematic racism is.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still all of these issues anyway. Like, they've just changed over time, right? And I think that it's really important to watch a film like this and see what things were like in the 30s. Because again, as we've talked about, history has a tendency to rhyme.
Yeah. And again, I really want to make it clear. I'm not saying that I think things are better now. Or that I'm saying that the issues this movie presents aren't still incredibly relevant. My issue is more that the solutions that this movie presents seem a little quaint in 2024. Does that make sense? Am I...
We're going to have to talk about this in the deep dive, I think, in very much detail, because I somewhat understand what you're saying, but I also just like... don't agree with it at all.
So is this going to be another Aguirre situation where you and I square off? Maybe this is a Vintage Cinema Rewind tradition where every year you and I just really disagree on something.
Yeah, I think we might on this one, actually. The other thing that I want to say about this film and who it's for is something that you kind of touched on a few minutes ago. This is probably more of a North American staple than it is a global staple. And that's not to say that, you know, everywhere except for North America has solved racism and systematic injustices, obviously.
No, it's funnily enough, wherever there's humans, there's systematic injustice. We just bring it with us wherever we go.
Yeah, but I think that growing up in North America, I think, you know, we're more connected to this film. Whereas if you and I were to watch a film about, like, apartheid, for example, in South America... South Africa, we would probably not feel as connected or not understand it as well as somebody from South Africa might.
No, certainly not. And I feel like you and I do connect with this movie in some ways just because you and I are Canadian, spoiler alert. But by the way, Tim Hortons, if you want to sponsor our podcast, we're both really open to that. So, anyways,
actually, no, I don't like Tim Hortons, so I'm fine with them never sponsoring us.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed. I hope you're enjoying my final episode on Vintage Cinema Rewind. I'm breaking up with two people I love today, but
yeah.
Anyways, what was I even talking about?
I have no idea. But yeah, this movie, Tim Hortons.
You brought up Tim Hortons and then derailed everything like you always do. No, but like you and I are Canadian. We didn't grow up in Alabama in the 30s, but we both grew up in a very, very white, very, very, very small town, right? So like I do feel like we can kind of connect with these characters in the story very well. Just
the childhood aspect of it, yes.
Yeah, and the setting kind of to an extent.
Yeah, we lived in rural Ontario, like... You know, like, woo! Obviously rural Ontario and rural Alabama in 1930 are a little bit different, but...
Just a little, but yeah.
But I think that kind of, again, makes it a little bit more of an interesting nostalgia trip for us.
Yeah, agreed.
So maybe that's who this movie is for as well, is for those kids who grew up in those small towns across North America.
Yeah, that's the weirdest answer we've ever given for this question. But
no, it's just the nostalgia of it, right? Like, and the nostalgia for your childhood.
I guess so, yeah.
Crisscrossed with messages about racism and Michael not being happy with how much is done for racism in 1930.
Yeah. I'm sorry for being anti-racism, but that's a pretty noble position to have, actually.
All right, What one scene to sell this movie did you choose?
I feel like just for one last time, you should explain to the viewers at home what we're doing with this section.
So one scene to sell the movie is our recommendation for a movie clip to check out on YouTube that we recommend you watch instead of the movie trailer, because watching a 60-year-old movie trailer for To Kill a Mockingbird is really not going to do the film justice, because that's a marketing tool that was used in 1962 to sell this movie to that audience.
It's a marketing tool developed by tools who work in marketing.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Thank you.
So what one scene did you choose?
Actually, it's on Movie Clips, the YouTube channel. It's the third one. The clip is called The Children Save Atticus. It's when Atticus Finch is guarding Tom Robinson in the jail cell while the sheriff is off dealing with something, and a mob shows up to lynch the poor guy before the trial can even take place. And honestly, for me, this was like, I got teary-eyed during this scene.
Yes.
Like, I can't even really explain it. I just got like, this scene kind of broke my heart. Like, just something about it. I won't get too much into it just because this is still the spoiler-free episode, but basically, yeah, Atticus gets called away in the middle of the night to guard the jail cell while the sheriff deals with something, and Jem and the other two kids follow him, and then, yeah, this mob shows up, and the children kind of inadvertently intervene, and it's a very tense, very moving scene, and, like, honestly, yeah, I would encourage you, if you're not sure about this movie, and even if you've seen this movie before, like, I'd go check this scene out, because it is, like, heartbreaking and moving in all the right ways. Like, I really want to make it clear, I don't hate this movie. I don't think it's a badly made, like, movie. Mm-hmm. I just have some issues with it. But this scene in particular, you know, I have a lot of admiration for moments and scenes like this in this movie.
And you know what? This is actually the first time that this happened on the podcast, is I actually chose the same scene as the one scene to sell the movie. And for all the same reasons that you did, it's funny because I think that this is the one scene that marries the two very different parts of this film together. It brings together the childhood aspect of it and that childhood wonder and how children view the world and
the innocence of it. Yeah.
And the innocence of it as well, right? And then it also brings in to play the legal aspect, to a little bit of a lesser degree, but the racism, the idea of like a lynch mob and like that mob mentality, right? And how it actually comes down to children who are able to kind of cut through that mob mentality and essentially save the day here.
Yeah, by accident.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, and it's the innocence that breaks the mob apart.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's a very touching scene. Like, I was getting emotional rewatching it, actually, just as its standalone scene.
Yeah, it's incredibly well done. This movie is incredibly well done.
Mm-hmm. When to watch, I think we've already kind of touched on this a little bit, that I would be actually a pretty big champion of this in being included in high schools and getting to watch this movie well and read it as well. I think that's the prime time to be watching it. Otherwise, like, you know, like, this is probably a Sunday kind of film.
This very much is definitely a Sunday movie.
Yeah. I was actually reading last week, funny enough, that this book has actually been pulled from a school district in British Columbia for being too racist and not holding up to modern times and the use of the N-word and stuff like that in this movie. Because that's also something we should say in...
Yeah, trigger warning. Yeah.
The N-word gets used in very vile ways, and that's kind of the point of its use, is to remind you, like, you know, the significance of it.
It's not Tarantino levels of excessive, but it's definitely prevalent.
Well, and it's more vile in that sense, right? Like, it's not black people using it towards black people. It's white people talking down to other people and again, like I said, using it in the most vile sense, like degrading black people down to animals, essentially.
Yeah.
And lesser beings. So it's,
yeah.
This is one of those things where it's so weird that, like, I just can't believe that a school would, although I can believe that a school might take something like this out, but I just remember reading, like, other stuff in school, like The Kite Runner and...
Or, like, Of Mice and Men, for instance.
Yeah, like, yeah. Other stuff that was, you know, it was, like, it was the same kind of, like, dark tones and, like, these kind of world-expanding ideas and thoughts and hatred and novels that I think it kind of tries to help contextualize some of this hate, because, like, at the end of the day, this is actually one of the quotes from the movie and probably from the novel as well, where Atticus says to Jem, like, you know, I tried to shield you from all of the darkness of the world, but at the end of the day, like, you're gonna have to experience it at some point, right?
Yeah, right. And again, that kind of comes into play later in the movie where, again, I'm not going to spoil it, but Atticus, I mean, I may as well spoil it because you've all seen it, but I won't. But Atticus has to go deliver some really, really bad news. And Jem, his 10-year-old son's like, I'm coming with you, Dad. And Atticus is like, no, stay home. And then Jem's like, I want to come with you. And then Atticus just looks at him. He's like, yeah, okay. Like, he's like, yeah, you're old enough. You may as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyways, but I digress.
Where to watch right now, To Kill a Mockingbird is streaming on Plex, but you can rent it just about anywhere.
Yep, I watched it on Plex. I did not rent it on YouTube this time.
Cool. I don't have a Plex subscription. Do you?
It's free, but it has ads, so it's annoying.
Okay.
I just wanted to save $5 this weekend.
That's
so
fair.
Yeah.
Cool. And then otherwise, that's it for the primer episode, the spoiler-free discussion. I hope that we've interested you in checking this one out, or maybe even like me revisiting this one from your teenage years, because I think that, again, it plays into the nostalgia of where I was at that point in my life and then even back to my childhood. I'm looking forward to the deep dive discussion to really hash this one out with you. Clearly, we have a bone to pick on this one. I was not expecting it, but...
tune in next week when Blake and I throw down... I don't really actually think you and I disagree that much. I think I just have stronger opinions on how the material was portrayed.
Yeah, and I think that it's hard to kind of discuss our opinions in full detail while also keeping things spoiler-free, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we're dancing around so much that, like, I don't actually fully even know that I understand your outlook of this movie yet, so stay
tuned. Honestly, knowing me, like, I always see Blake and I are very different people. He's more, what is it, like, he's more organized and right brain, and I'm more chaotic and left brain. So, like, a lot of times I formulate my opinion by arguing with Blake, so yeah. Anyways,
yeah, so I'm really looking forward to our discussion next week, and we'll also compare and contrast this to Lawrence of Arabia and probably some other modern day films as well, as always. So
yeah.
Alrighty then. I'll see you next time. Tell your dad.
Tell your dad.
And I don't know, all of your high school teachers.
Call, hit up your high school teacher on Facebook. See how he or she is doing. If you want. I don't know.
You
want
to shout out an old English teacher right now?
I don't know that I should.
Okay, we're not going to then.
Actually, I don't think I should, because they never gave me this book. So, I mean, if they wanted a shout out 15 years later, they should have done their jobs a little better.
Well, I guess I'm shouting out Miss Hamilton. Thanks for letting me read and watch this movie. All right, see you next time.
Bye-bye.